Hi, welcome to D-Listers of History, a podcast about people you've never heard of who have changed the world. My name is Fega, and I'm a public historian and also on the mend, but still a little bit sick. So please forgive my voice. I've got cough drops. I've got water. Hopefully we can get through this thing without a coughing fit.
My name is Mazal. I am a fiber artist, a mixed media artist, a history enthusiast, and I'm Fega's wife.
And I just realized I didn't come up with a clever way to get us into today's topic. Here's what the thing is I used to have a job at a tourist site here in Philadelphia called Eastern State Penitentiary. And I still like to work there during Halloween season. And it's such a fun building. Like, I think you agree with me.
It's a very fun building.
And I feel okay saying that because the interpretation done there is done very sensitively and with an eye to modern issues around mass incarceration and so forth. It's not one of these prison museums where it's like, woo,
prisons. We imprison people, woohoo. Let's all pretend to be in cells. And
yeah, it's not that. It's just such a fascinating place. And there's so much to know about it. They're still learning so much about it. And so I've been wanting to do the D-lister for a while, and that is John Haviland.
Yeah, he is the architect of Eastern State Penitentiary.
Yes. We'll talk a little bit more later about what makes Eastern State architecturally interesting, but the sort of baseline to start from is that it is the world's first fully dedicated, built-to-purpose penitentiary. So penitentiary comes from the term penitent, so it's supposed to inspire penitence. So it's around the solitary system or the Pennsylvania system, and it had been done before in other places, but this was the first time that all of these various ideas around penal architecture came together into this one building and inspired a lot of stuff.
So if it wasn't clear, penitence, for people who don't know, is a religious concept in really sort of thing. I guess it's like teshuva in Judaism, is really thinking
I like how you're trying to explain this to a general audience, and you're like, here's a Hebrew word. Let's take this word that they probably already know, but like, let's just make sure they understand it.
Yeah.
And compare it to a word that they definitely do not know.
I mean, I'm just saying that this is a concept in other religions. Yes. I don't know about other religions besides that. Like, we're Jewish. I know about Christianity in the general sense of we live in America.
I mean, okay, so
but if you want to get
technical about penitence, it's not just saying sorry. It's about making it better. It is about,
and it's about really feeling that and really coming to terms that you have done something bad, whatever the quote-unquote bad thing might be. It might be something that's actually bad. It might be something that is just not thought well of in whatever society you're in, and really coming to terms with that. And that's the penitence. The part in your mind is the penitence, and then the actions you do on that is penance, which a lot of people have heard of, especially in like Catholicism.
The thing that makes the idea philosophically of a penitentiary different from a prison is it's not based around the idea of punishment necessarily. Mm-hmm. So in prison theory, this is like your 101 criminal justice class that I haven't taken. I just worked at a historical prison. There are a couple of reasons why prisons exist. One is punishment. Another is to reform the person, which is like your penitence. The one is deterrence. So that's to try to prevent people from committing crimes in the first place. I didn't realize I was going to talk about this, and I'm blanking on the fourth. There is another one. Deterrence, punishment. Oh, incapacitation. Incapacitation. So that's like removing people from society. So if somebody is a danger to themselves or others, prison in its philosophical concept removes that person and makes that person safe. It's the idea anyway. Obviously, here in the United States,
we've gone off the deep end.
we've things went off the rails a little bit in the 70s and 80s. We're not going to go into that really that much because of time. But if you are interested in that topic, I will include some relevant links in the show notes. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, go check the links in the show notes. There's a lot to know. You could come with me. You could come with me. So, John Haviland.
Yes.
The man, the myth, the legend. Born December 12th, 1792, in Gundenham Manor near Taunton, Somerset, England, to James and Anne Haviland. In 1811, he apprenticed to a London architect, James Elmes, which some of the sources I looked at made a lot of fuss about the fact that James Elmes was only 10 years older than John Haviland. So maybe, I guess that wasn't typical to have that close of a age gap, but I feel like there's a lot that happens in 10 years. Like, I'm sure James had plenty to teach John. But at any rate, John Haviland didn't stick around for the whole time of his apprenticeship. He left after 4 years because he wanted to be appointed to the Russian Imperial Corps of Engineers. So he went to Russia to try to achieve that.
Okay.
That was just a thing you did back in those days.
Yeah.
He was not successful, but the Russia trip was well worthwhile because while he was in Russia, he met a whole bunch of important people, including George von Sontag and John Quincy Adams.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to talk about George von Sontag first because no one's heard of him. In fact, I had to go to German Wikipedia to get any information about this man. But he was an American, and he had ended up in the Russian Navy. A volunteer. His story is actually pretty wild, but not what we're talking about today. The more important contact was John Quincy Adams, future president and then ambassador from America to Russia. And both John Quincy Adams and George von Sontag convinced Haviland that he should go to Philadelphia, go to America, and basically make his fortune as an architect. So John Quincy Adams provided Haviland with letters of introduction to like President James Monroe and people like that to get him on the right path.
Mm-hmm.
No, networking, y'all. Networking. So Haviland arrives in Philadelphia in 1816, and he did pretty well for himself. He got married. He wrote a 3-volume book called The Builder's Assistant, which is of note because it is the earliest architectural pattern book that was written and published in North America. I didn't know what an architectural pattern book.
I was about to ask.
I didn't think to look that up. I'm assuming that's like where you have a book where you're looking, you can see like the different types of columns and stuff. That could be completely wrong. But I figure that's got to exist, right? Like somehow people know. Okay, a pattern book is, it's more like a sewing pattern. So it's
interesting.
It's for builders who are not architects so that they can just copy what other architects have done. And they're really important because they are very influential in spreading architectural styles for obvious reasons. While Haviland's doing all of this, getting himself born and established and so forth, there is a group being formed called the Philadelphia Society for Alleviating the Miseries of Public Prisons, which is a great name. Excellent name. Mm-hmm. It's a mouthful. They are still around, but they do not use that name anymore.
Yeah, now they are the Pennsylvania Prison Society. They're actually a pretty cool organization.
Yes, and a much better name. But
yeah,
back in those days, it was founded by Dr. Benjamin Rush in 1787. What he was thinking about when he founded this was a lot of things, but specifically Walnut Street Prison. Walnut Street Prison was the main prison in Philadelphia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
It sits right next to what is now Washington Square. Where it was is now like an old publishing building that's now like condos or something. But it was pretty terrible.
Yeah.
But the thing is Walnut Street Prison was not uniquely terrible. It was pretty much the same as every other prison in the Anglo world.
Mm-hmm. It was originally built with the concept of just being basically a bunch of large rooms to hold people while they awaited trial. And there was very little consideration for, if any, there really no consideration for prisoner well-being. Fights broke out regularly.
And everybody was together. So if you were picked up on pickpocketing, you were in the same room as someone who might have murdered their spouse.
Mm-hmm. And it became really overcrowded really quickly.
And also, when I say everyone, I mean everyone. Like men, women, children, everyone in between. So really dangerous, really terrible. And there was this concern that people who were going in for relatively minor crimes would learn how to do bigger crimes because they're just like right there with mm-hmm. these like big time criminals.
Just talking to them all day.
Yeah, because there's nothing else to do. The wardens weren't paid. How they got their pay was by selling things to the prisoners.
Interesting. I didn't see yeah, that.
Yeah, including beer.
That's an interesting system.
The beer really helped a lot.
I mean, it's probably safer than their water.
And the people who had a lot of money sometimes were allowed to like come and go as they pleased because they could. It was just a really terrible system. But at Walnut Street, people running it decided to start experimenting with this new idea, and that was the penitentiary system, which the penitentiary system can be a lot of different things, but it always includes solitary confinement. And it was considered a more humane form of imprisonment.
Mm-hmm. And at the time, Philadelphia Society for Alleviating Miseries of Public
the miseries
Prisons.
Of-
alleviating the miseries of public prisons. They were big proponents of this. There were all sorts of petitions and protests. And I mean, and meanwhile, as this is going on in Walnut Street Prison, there were several fires broke out. There were lots of riots. There were several people escaped. Like, it was a mess.
Yeah. It's also important to note that Philadelphia is a Quaker city. So one thing I've learned as a tour guide is that people don't know who the Quakers were or are. They're still around in rather large numbers. Quakers are a Christian religious group who believe that every single person has a little piece of God inside of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this has a number of implications. One of the more famous ones is pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
Another one is they were early adopters of abolitionism. So although there were many Quakers in early America who enslaved people, that was eventually earlier than anyone else done away with because someone sat down and said, oh, wait. Men and women were relatively equal compared to the outside world. Today, we would not look at it as equal, but compared to just the rest of Philadelphia, it was much more equal. And one of the things they really believed was that if that little piece of God inside of you isn't shining, there must be something in society that is causing that to happen. So Eastern State Penitentiary, the Society for Alleviating the Miseries of Public Prisons, these were not explicitly Quaker organizations, but the Quakers had a huge amount of influence in Philadelphia society at the time. Like Dr. Benjamin Rush was not a Quaker. And so this is where we get the Pennsylvania system. Eventually, this is how it shakes out. So when people talk about the Pennsylvania system, this is what they're talking about. So there's solitary confinement with work, with labor. There is every attempt made to encourage penitence. So what this looks like is a lot of different things, but one is that you're in solitary confinement, but you do get certain approved visitors, that being like a chaplain or your own sort of religious figure or the warden who's supposed to act in a sort of like counselor-y sort of
mm-hmm.
capacity. So you've got some people coming and talking to you who are supposed to be encouraging you to get on the right road. There's a focus on secrecy and privacy, this idea that you should be able to go into prison and nobody know you were there so mm-hmm. that you can get a job when you leave.
Yeah, which is a big problem in today's world.
Yes. And also not interacting with other prisoners for the aforementioned reason, and also for the reason I mentioned way, way before, which was to prevent people from falling further into the criminal act. They actually refer to people as being part of a criminal class at the time. It's a little weird.
Yeah.
But that's the Pennsylvania system in a big old nutshell. In 1821, the Pennsylvania legislature approved funding to build an Eastern State Penitentiary using solitary confinement with labor. I note with labor because there was quite a bit of debate about whether it should be without labor or with labor. The idea was without labor, the sentences could be shorter because people thought that if there was nothing to do in solitary confinement, it would take much less time to become penitent. That's, of course, horrifying. And while it took them a while to figure out that solitary confinement, period, is horrifying, they at least realized that that's just a little too much. So
yeah, well, there were signs from the start that this was awful, but people were very, you know, confirmation bias is a hell of a drug, and people really wanted, they really wanted this to work. They wanted this to be the magic answer. Yeah, and so a lot of different things got pulled out as maybe this is to blame. Maybe that is to blame.
Mm-hmm. And actually, the Marquis de Lafayette came and visited before the construction was completed. And he told people, he's like, I was in solitary confinement when I was a prisoner of war. You cannot do this to people. But they didn't listen to the Marquis. So the money was approved, 1821. The new prison would hold 250 people. And at this point, 1821, John Haviland is growing a bit of a name for himself. He has his book, but he's still relatively unknown in comparison to other architects in the city. There's not a ton of architects, but he's young and he's from another place, and sort of thing. But he was nonetheless requested to submit a potential plan to the committee to decide what this prison was going to look like. And whoever's design won was going to get $100. Another person who put in a design was the famous William Strickland.
Okay.
So if you are a person with any knowledge of architecture or history in the Mid-Atlantic region,
you've heard the name.
You've heard the name William Strickland. You might not be able to say anything about him, but you've heard the name William Strickland. He is a big deal architect. Like, he's the guy who designed the current bell tower on Independence Hall. Like, he's a big deal. And also apparently kind of a jerk. So he submitted a design. This whole section, by the way, is not that important, but I just think it's funny and I just need to share it with the world. So he submitted a design and he thought he was a shoo-in because, first of all, he's super famous. He designed the Second Bank of the United States. Like, come on. And also he had designed Western State Penitentiary, which was not yet complete and actually had a lot of issues, some of which were his fault, some of which were not. The prison in Pittsburgh was really a fiasco. Like, I found this article that was super interesting of the blow-by-blow of, like, everything that went wrong in trying to build this prison. And one of the issues was that he designed it for solitary confinement without labor, because that's what he was told to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then they changed their minds partway through. And there also was a dedicated, there wasn't, like, dedicated yards for each individual prisoner. There was, like, a single yard
that everybody used. Yeah, so yeah. For exercise, they were going out of solitary confinement.
It wasn't a circle, it was like kind of an octagon kind of situation. So all the cells were kind of, like, on an outer wall. And also, when he first put in the designs, they didn't have any measurements.
Oh.
Yeah.
I feel like that's necessary.
Yes. This article that I found about the prison in Pittsburgh is from 1957, from the Pennsylvania Magazine of History and Biography by Eugene E. Dahl. And I just need to quote him about this design and William Strickland's role in it, because it is so delicious. Whatever the origin and subsequent development of the plan, its adoption was a catastrophe, both architecturally and financially. It has been suggested that the design shows the influence of both the famous prison at Ghent in the Austrian Netherlands and of the fantastic theoretical panopticon conceived by Jeremy Bentham and his brother. One might also say that it appropriated the worst features of both buildings and combined them in the most inappropriate manner.
Wow, that's a burn for an architect.
Yep. Haviland, on the other hand, take a look at all these different famous prisons. So the one at Ghent is a good example. That was, like, a really famous prison at the time, and took the things that worked and removed the things that didn't and made this new plan. That was the first time all these various theories of this era around prison design, he put all that together. This plan, that it's not perfect, but it's pretty good. It's actually, I think it's a really, it's weird to say that a prison's beautiful, but it's a really beautiful building. Strickland was hired as the superintendent of the project because the idea was they preferred Haviland's plan, but he was young and inexperienced, and they didn't love the idea of him being responsible for what would end up being, like, one of the most expensive.
The most expensive. Yeah,
like, building projects in Pennsylvania history. And
I thought it was history of the entire country.
At the time, certainly.
Yeah, no, at the time.
So Strickland was hired to superintend the project, which he thought meant that his design was chosen, which it wasn't. And Strickland threw an entire fit over this. And thankfully, most of this fit was done over letters, because Strickland was in Europe at the time. So now we get to see everything that was said, and it is wonderful. Strickland, in the end, he rage quit, basically, from the project.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and then Haviland was installed as superintendent of the project and finally got his $100. It's funny, so he kind of rage quits, but it's that sort of like, you can't fire me, I quit kind of situation. So the committee wrote a resolution on the whole matter, and this is a quote from that. Any further communication with William Strickland is unnecessary. That the superintendent and clerk be informed that he has no authority over them, nor any superintendents of the building, and that the clerk be directed to return him all his plans and drawings, as well as the prison, as of the front building and outer wall, and inform him that this board do not recognize nor consider him as their architect. So basically, like, give Strickland back all of his stuff so that he can't claim that we, like, stole it, and just get him out of here.
Just wash your hands.
Yeah, just gone. And now we have this young British architect in charge. There was some drama, as you might expect, with publicly funded projects, but nothing that rose to the level of Strickland. Mostly had to do with the gatehouse, or the front building that they referred to at the time. We now call it the gatehouse.
Mm-hmm.
The gatehouse is where the wardens would have lived with their families, because Eastern State Penitentiary at the time was not close to the city. It was quite a ways out of it. Like, today it's in the city of Philadelphia, but the city of Philadelphia was a lot smaller in those days. And so housing was part of what a warden would get. And I say wardens because there were two wardens there for a time. There was a men's warden and a woman's warden. It was called a matron. But they both lived in the gatehouse, and people were upset with Haviland because he picked fireplace mantles that were too nice. So they cost more. And Haviland handled this, I think, very elegantly, where he was like, listen, I can't take them out. I'll just pay the extra $200 for the difference of what you were expecting versus what it was. And you know what's really tragic? We don't know where these things are. Because in the 1950s, they renovated the building and they got rid of all those mantles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I don't know what they looked like. They must have been great, but who knows? I'm sure there's pictures somewhere. Okay. So there was the issue with the mantles. People just thought that the whole front building was just too elaborate. And when you go by, you can see why people might have thought that, because it looks like a castle.
Mm-hmm.
The entire thing is done in Gothic Revival style, and it looks like a castle. Like,
yeah,
with armaments and stuff. Most of it is a trick of the eye. Like, a lot of the armaments are only like 6 inches tall, but they look like real from the ground. But nonetheless, they bothered with all that, which, you know, costs money. And Haviland kept busy during this time. While he was in charge of this project, he also designed several other notable Philadelphia buildings, including, but not exclusively, the original Franklin Institute, which is now the Atwater Kent Museum, Walnut Street Theater, which is the oldest continuously operating theater in the United States, the Pennsylvania Institution for the Deaf and Dumb, now the Dorrance Hamilton Hall at UArts. That's what they called it. I'm sorry. And he also helped with some of the second story renovation at Independence Hall. So he just was like doing all this at the same time. Construction was completed in 1836, though prisoners had been housed there since 1829, including the first escape from that front building.
Mm-hmm.
In 1832 by William Hamilton is also my favorite escape.
Yeah.
Because he was working as like a waiter kind of, like as like a butler kind of situation for the warden, which, how can he do that and be in solitary confinement? And the answer is he can't. There were a lot of issues. I was going to say in the early days, but there were a lot of issues like
just throughout.
Eternally at Eastern State Penitentiary. And he saw an opportunity. He was left alone at some point. So he just like lowered himself out a window and walked away. He was recaptured because he stole a pig. Because remember, it's 1832. I forgot
about that part of the story.
Yeah, actually, it just popped in my brain. I didn't write it down. He did escape again, and I think the same way. Like,
they did not learn from their mistakes the first time.
There's a reason why there was a big investigation in the 1830s. But at any rate, that's just funsies. I could talk about Eastern State, the building, left, right, and center all day, but we're not doing that. Why is Eastern State Penitentiary special? Why is it of note? We talked about this a little bit already, but I'm going to more directly describe what the building looks like. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to understand.
I agree.
So it uses what is called a radial plan. The original plan, so like what Haviland drew on the paper, and I mentioned that because things started changing even while they were building the building. It was comprised of 7 single-story cell blocks with barrel-vaulted ceilings, radiating out from a central surveillance hub like spokes on a bicycle wheel. Each cell was about 8 feet by 12 feet, had a window that opened to allow fresh air in. In the back of the cell was a door that would go out into a solitary exercise yard that they would spend an hour total in, 2 half-hour shifts, assuming the weather was good. And there's also another door.
And that's each day.
Yes. And there was another door in the back of the exercise yard that went out to like the outside. There on the other opposite end, so on the cell block side, there wasn't a door, but there was a feeding hole that the guards would then put the food in that they brought around on carts, and they tried to maintain silence. Mm-hmm. And so the guards would put like socks over their shoes and things like that. Also, every single cell had running water. Eastern State Penitentiary had running water before the White House, given that Andrew Jackson was president at that time. I think that's great. But anyway, so they had toilets. Now, we would be pretty horrified by said toilets today. They were basically a funnel that got flushed maybe like once a week. That changed over time how often it got flushed. But it was still better than dealing with chamber pots. Mm-hmm. There was also indoor heating, which did not work very well, unfortunately. But the idea was that it would be there. It was supposed to radiate from the floors, and it just didn't work very well. And whenever they needed to engage in a trade, if the prisoner already knew a trade, they'd be provided with what they needed for that. And if they didn't know a trade, they'd be taught one. And they had access to a full library that actually, like, by the late 19th century, mid to late 19th century, was like pretty good library.
I also want to make clear the doors between the cell and the corridor, they were not. It wasn't just bars that you can see through.
You had a feeding hole, and that was it.
It was a solid door, and I think there was.
No, it wasn't a door. There was no door.
Like,
I know why. So there's doors now. So okay. That's why you think there's doors. The original design, there were no doors.
So they all came in from the outside.
Yes.
Okay. Interesting. When did the doors get put in?
They stopped. So the last cell block that was built with feeding holes was cell block 3. They built the cell blocks in numerical order. Cell block 3 was the last one with feeding holes. And by that time, the guards had complained enough.
Yeah.
Because it was a pain. Anytime they needed to go into a cell, they had to like walk all the way outside and walk all the way back. And so if there's bad weather, or if they think somebody is like, I don't know, self-harming or something, like it takes a long time.
It's huge. Like this building is huge. It's
so big. And it just was inconvenient. And so they cut out all the feeding holes and made doors. There are only a handful of feeding holes left, and those are in cell block 3, which is the hospital block. They're there just because of, like, not even going to get into it. Tuberculosis. It's because of tuberculosis. But take the tour. Go to Eastern State, take the tour. The reason for the window as well that you could open was because one of the things that they were really concerned about in the building at Eastern State was to prevent disease. Mm-hmm. And
that had been a huge problem in previous prisons.
They would get what they called jail fever, which I think was typhus. There was this thing at the time that people would call, like, if you just got sort of sick randomly, they would call it wherever you physically are fever. So it's like bog fever, jail fever, boat fever. I don't know. So it was typhus. It was actually fairly effective as far as disease control for certain diseases. Mm-hmm. Wildly ineffective for tuberculosis. But when the flu pandemic happened in the early 20th century, I think they lost like less than 5 people.
Wow.
Yeah, because they went back. At the time, they had moved away from the solitary system. They went back to the solitary system and basically did what we were supposed to be doing during lockdown. And it worked. They didn't let anybody in or out, and they didn't get the flu.
Yeah.
funny how that works. There's a lot of questions about how original Havilland's design was, because there were a lot of similar designs in Europe at the time, like we've talked about the prison at Ghent a few times. But wherever he got the idea from, Eastern State was the first fully dedicated penitentiary building. And that design was, as a result, historically noteworthy and has been used again. Like, it's inspired around 300 prisons around the world, many of which are still in operation today. It was actually a tourist destination. Like, it was supposed to be the latest and greatest in prison technology. People would come to visit the prison while it was an active prison. Like, wow. As tourists, which is weird. I think it's weird. There were a lot of issues, like I said, with overcrowding and the prison not living up to its arguably noble philosophy over the years, but that's not really the focus today. The focus is on John Havilland. So actually, I'm going to talk a little bit about that on the Substack over the course of the next week. So If you are not following us on Substack, you should do that. It doesn't cost you anything unless you want it to. And you don't have to have like an account or whatever with Substack. Like, it'll just go to your email. I have like the post-Eastern State Havilland stuff, but I thought we would talk a little bit about solitary confinement.
Yeah.
So is that what you wanted to talk about next? I don't know. I kind of gave him Mazzal like a list of things that would be cool. And so I actually don't really know what Mazzal's going to talk about.
I mean, I have a whole list of things that I don't think are all going to fit into the episode. Some of that we can put on the Substack as well. There have been a lot of studies. We've known since the start that solitary confinement was real bad, folks. There's been a lot of studies since then that have shown what some of these different effects are that come out of them. The most notable ones, I would say, for the people who have been in solitary confinement are the health effects. There are psychological effects. There are a lot of psychological effects, but it's not just psychological effects. There are physical effects as well. There's actually an article called "The Impacts of Solitary Confinement" by Kayla James and Elena Vanko that was written in 2021 for the Vera Institute of Justice. You can put a link to this report. It has some really great... They work in the way that my brain works, which is basically an outline. So they talk about like the psychological effects, give a list of various things, neurological effects, give a list of various things, physiological, et cetera, et cetera. There are a lot of things. Like, some of the things that have been noted are anxiety, anger, depression, insomnia, impulse control issues, paranoia, hypersensitivity, obsessive thoughts, cognitive disturbances, PTSD, loss of identity, psychosis.
Seems like the opposite of inspiring penitence.
I know, right? There's also neurological effects. Says there's one, and they are throughout this thing also like putting in notes to all of these studies that they're getting this from. Here's a quote that I found very interesting. "Even 1 week in solitary can lead to significant changes in electrical activity in the brain."
That's wild.
Yeah. Isn't that wild? Here's
that it's says, like, actually physically measurable. Yeah.
"Studies show that the brains of rodents subjected to isolation exhibit dramatic changes, including fewer neurons," which are nerve cells, "smaller neurons, decreased connections between neurons, and fewer blood vessels in the brain. You are also at higher risk for hypertension, heart attacks, strokes, premature death." And these effects are lasting even after very short stays. You could have spent so little time and have these effects for potentially your whole life. There's one study that found that formerly incarcerated people in Denmark who'd spent less than 7 days in solitary were found 5 years after release to have higher overall death rates from unnatural causes such as accident, suicide, and violence than people who had not spent time in solitary. There are also massive impacts on the people around people who've been in solitary confinement, family, the public. There's issues of public safety, reentry. There's a massive, massive economic impact both on the people who have been in solitary confinement and just in general on society. And I can go into this a bit more on the Substack as well.
I will note, given that with these numbers, the average stay in solitary in the United States, according to a 2021 Yale Law School report, was about 27 days. And that is well beyond.
That's continuous?
Yes. That is it's my understanding anyway. It says, and some people spend 6 years in there.
Yes, awful.
And the UN, I think, puts the amount at a week. I think it's a week or 10 days that is legally permitted by the United Nations.
The Federal Bureau of Prisons actually in 2013 estimated that it costs $216 per person per day just to hold people in solitary in the administrative maximum facility at the Federal Correctional Complex in Florence, Colorado. Meanwhile, the average cost of housing people just in the general population, same place, was $86 a day as opposed to $216 a day. So this is, even for people who don't care about humans, the actual people, which they should, to be very clear, even people who don't care about the people who are incarcerated in solitary confinement usually care about stuff like that. And yet things are not being done in a fast enough way that they are causing mass change. And so there, that it's not like no one's doing the work.
I won't say that. There's a lot of people doing a lot of work. It's just like moving a very large boat.
That's what I was saying. Yeah, it's not like no one's doing the work, but there is so much to do that more people need to do this work and more people need to even know about it in the first place.
That's a little insight into why the Pennsylvania system does not work, amongst other things. It failed for a lot of reasons at Eastern State, but the fact that it doesn't do what it's supposed to do is up there. But one of the other cool things about Eastern State is that, and why Haviland's design is so notable, is I keep saying like purpose built for the Pennsylvania system, for this penitentiary system. And there's a lot that goes into the architecture of the building that supports the idea of this solitary system. So there's a couple of things that go into it. Obviously, the whole like 7-cell blocks coming out, radiating from a center so that people can keep an eye on things. That's especially important for sound because, like I said, they wanted to maintain silence. And so if somebody was making a ruckus in their cell, a guard sitting in center could easily hear it. It could also easily hear it because of those barrel vaulted ceilings. So I said this is a Gothic Revival building. So Gothic, as an architectural style, is defined by great height and great light. And that is definitely what you get at Eastern State. It's mm-hmm. actually sort of fascinating because you walk down the cell block and it looks like a church.
Yeah.
But in its original design, the prisoner would have never seen that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it was supposed to like inspire the guards to be better. I don't know.
Maybe.
But it also, it creates this church-like feeling, but also it allows sound to carry very effectively, mm-hmm. which when you're trying to maintain a silent atmosphere is important. And it's so effective that I remember being there really early in the morning when there's like only people working there, like right after they open. And I could sometimes hear a video from the end of cell block 7 when I was like doing stuff in like cell block 2, which is like on the complete other side of the prison, because that's how well sound bounces around in there. There's a lot of issues with how it was built, not supporting in that like they started running out of space before they even finished the prison. So you end up with these like 2-story cell blocks, which mm-hmm. kind of defeat the entire purpose of being able to see from the center. A common misconception people will say to me when I talk about Eastern State, because I'm a big nerd and I'll just talk about Eastern State for no reason. I literally printed out the 500-page historic structures report. Like I have a problem. It's not behind you right now because I was using it for my notes.
Oh, you used to sit on the bookshelf that is directly
behind
me.
It'll be there
me.
Again. It's next to my desk right now. But the thing that people, and this came up actually in that Strickland quote, the thing that people oftentimes liken it to is a panopticon, which I was under the impression never existed.
Nope. Actually, I do have notes on that.
Well, can you talk about what it is?
Yeah.
First of all, and why Eastern State is not that, at all.
Yeah. So panopticon, it's from the Greek word I'm going to butcher this because I don't speak Greek, panoptes, which means all-seeing, literally as a literal translation. It was developed as a theory by Jeremy Bentham, who is an English social reformer and the founder of utilitarianism, as it were.
Huh.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah, at its most basic, a panopticon consists of cells in a circle around a central tower where there's a yard between the tower and the cells. In the tower, at the top of it, there will be a guard tower or guard room. I don't know. There's a room up top of the tower where the guards sit, and the prisoners can't see in very well, but the guard can see out. So while they can't look everywhere at once, technically, the prisoners do not know when they are and are not being watched. So the thought is that they would always be on their best behavior. Now, the reality is different, but that was the thought.
And also, like, one whole side of their cell would be open. So maybe you're getting into this. I don't know. I just feel like that's an important
piece. I had not gotten into that.
This is a really important piece of the panopticon, is that everybody is being observed, not just when they're in the yard, not just when they're in the hallway or whatever. It is every single moment, because their cell can be seen into by these guards.
That's what I was trying to get at.
Which is not the case at Eastern State.
No. No, you would be able to see everyone. And it wasn't specifically designed for solitary confinement either. I don't think there, as far as I could tell at least, there was nothing saying that it couldn't be multiple people in a cell. So the first one of those that were built, there aren't that many, but there are a few, five that I was able to find. There's what I think was the first one. It was the Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois, and then actually designed after that, Presidio Modelo in Cuba, where Fidel Castro actually stayed for 2 years, starting in 1952. And then there are three in the Netherlands, in Breda, Arnhem, and Haarlem.
I assume they're not still in use.
No.
Because as horrifying as the Pennsylvania system is, and it's horrifying, to me, the Panopticon is also horrifying, just in a very different way.
So the Presidio Modelo is a ruin. It's in the same way as Eastern State is, although I don't know. It's not a tourist destination as far as I can tell, because, I mean, from what I can tell, so it's on an island that is, you have to get special permits to be able to go to. Once you go to the island, from what I can tell, it's not blocked off or anything. You can go see it, but it's really hard to get to the island in the first place. I'm not sure if the others, that part of it is still in use. Stateville Correctional Center is still in use, but not as a panopticon anymore, as far as I can tell. I'm not sure about the ones in the Netherlands.
I'm sure not. The Netherlands is known for having
humane prisons. Well, there's very little that I was able to find in English.
Also, it's like a ridiculous thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jeremy Bentham, who developed them, was very angry for the rest of his life that it did not actually get put in place in England. There were these talks of one, Milbank Penitentiary, which was originally constructed as the National Penitentiary, was originally going to be developed as a panopticon, which he was very excited about, and then they changed plans while they were building, and he never got over it.
It's like, I guess, and maybe this isn't fair, because I don't know as much about the panopticon thing, but I look at the people who, like at John Haviland, and the people who were involved in the founding and building of Eastern State Penitentiary, and I see a lot of good intentions that created a situation that caused a lot of psychological torture. But that was not the intention in the outset. In fact, there's a book that they sell in the gift shop called Crucible of Good Intentions, which I think really sums up Eastern State pretty well. To me, the Panopticon just sounds like purpose-built psychological torture. Like the idea of like never knowing if you're being viewed, especially back in those days. Like today, we're kind of used to the idea, right? Because of cameras. So we're used to the idea today that we're probably looked at a lot. That wasn't the case back then. I mean, Jeremy Bentham was in the 18th century. This was like, this would have been a wildly new and horrifying thing to the prisoners.
Yeah, no, it was the goal of it from the start was that not knowing whether they were being watched or not would make them on their best behavior at all times. So that's panopticons. Eastern State is not a panopticon.
Oh, God. And also, I think part of it, too, is like Eastern State system, the Pennsylvania system, was built around this idea of reform. It was built around this idea of creating penitence. I mean, they wanted to maintain order, and the way they did that in real life versus theory was horrifying. But the theory was that if you just treated people nicely, they would behave themselves, which we now see in countries like Sweden and the Netherlands and Norway actually works pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, closing people up and not letting them talk to other human beings doesn't count as treating them nicely.
Everyone got a Bible, though.
Everyone got a Bible, and then more than a Bible eventually.
Our cat is trying to break into the pantry as we're doing this. He's fully, we pushed a box up against the pantry. There is the door doesn't latch properly because it's a very old house. We have a doorstop and then two boxes in front of it. And he's just fully sitting in the box with vegetables in it. It's our CSA box and just trying to break into the pantry.
I just can't with this cat. And looking to today, I think it is important to look at other countries and what they're doing in their prison system. If you happen to live near the Philadelphia area, Eastern State Penitentiary is worth a visit, not just because it's a really cool museum, but because they have an exhibit called Prisons Today, which goes into all this theoretical stuff. And they do, I think, have some stuff online. So if you go to their website, there is information. I actually, at this conference that I got this illness from, I actually met someone who interned at Eastern State Penitentiary and was responsible for a huge amount of Prisons Today. So after Eastern State Penitentiary was built, Haviland was mostly known for prison design. He received several commissions around the country to build other prisons. Like famously in this area, there was a prison in Trenton that he designed around the same principles as Eastern State. And like I said, around the world, this radial plan has been used. It's still in use in a modified form.
Mm-hmm.
It just makes a lot of sense as far as like being able to see what's going on in a building. But Philadelphians became less and less impressed with him because he made a lot of unwise speculations into his own projects. So these are things like commercial arcades and an amusement park, which I'm very curious as to what an early 19th century amusement park would have looked like. Probably terrifying. But nonetheless, none of these speculations worked.
A lot of OSHA violations, I'm
sure. Oh my gosh. I already am very like skeptical of a lot of these amusement parks because I'm not going on a roller coaster that can also fold up into a semi. Like, I'm just not doing it.
Vega does not like roller coasters. I like roller coasters.
I mean, I don't like roller coasters, period. But if I'm going to, like, suffer through a roller coaster, it is not going to be one that can fold up into a semi. Like, it's just no. So Haviland eventually went to bankruptcy. And on March 28th, 1852, at the age of 59, Haviland died suddenly of apoplexy, which is now called
apoplexy.
There it is. Which is now called a stroke.
Mm-hmm.
I kept the word suddenly in there because that's what all the like material said. But I don't. Can you not suddenly get a stroke? Like, isn't it like by its very nature kind of a sudden thing?
I mean, I guess so. I guess nowadays we can track people's blood pressure and know when they're more likely or less likely to have a stroke. That was not. I don't know.
Yeah, but this is 1852. We hadn't figured out like hand washing yet.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly when blood pressure monitoring became a possibility.
Well, at any rate, he suddenly died and he was buried in the family vault in St. Andrew's Church, which he had designed. Not the vault, like the whole church. That church is now St. George Greek Orthodox Cathedral. Interestingly, a lot of materials will say that he is buried there. And that is not the case. He is not buried there. Everybody from the vaults and from the graveyard and so forth when the building was sold to the Greek Orthodox community, all those people were exhumed.
Interesting.
And moved. They were moved to St. Andrew's, which is on Penn's campus. But it's kind of unclear where he is now in that process. I found this absolutely wild article on Hidden City by Nicholas Pappas that I'm going to include because we do not have time to go through it. But he like went on, he went down the rabbit hole of like, where is John Haviland? What he, to the TLDR, too long didn't read of it, is he's probably in a mass grave with the other people from that church buried at St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Exton, Pennsylvania. But there's several other possibilities. And some of them are pretty wild. Definitely recommend giving that a read.
I will.
That's John Haviland and Eastern State Penitentiary, one of my favorite places. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
You can support us in a whole bunch of different ways. Mm-hmm. One is just by listening until now, which is awesome. You can tell your friends about the Listeners of History.
Yeah, that is a really great way.
You can put a review in on your podcatcher of choice.
Mm-hmm.
We are soon, well, we are kind of on YouTube right now, but we will soon more properly be on YouTube. So you can check us out there and subscribe.
Also, we have a Patreon.
We have a Patreon.
And we have a Substack.
There's also, if you'll look in the show notes, we have like affiliate links for like the books that were used in this. Mm-hmm. So if you want to like,
if you really
buy a book, it kicks us probably like 20 cents, but you know.
But more importantly, you can dig more into the sources that we have been using.
And you are very encouraged to do that. If I or either of us were wrong about something, feel free to send us an email. You can also find us on all the various social media platforms with the exception of X, because I just will not. So you can find us on TikTok, Instagram, etc. All of those links can be found at our website, www.delistersofhistory.com.
And that is D as in the letter D.
We are a weekly podcast. Our next episode will be out on May 6th. It will be a sidebar episode where we will discuss the historical stories around a modern contemporary event. And the week after that, May 13th, will be our next biography episode. And we don't have that totally tic-tac and tied yet as to who that's going to be. But I think it's going to be Chevalier d'Eon, who was a French spy who lived half of his life as a woman and half of his life as a man. And there's a lot. He is a drama queen.
We are so, so thankful to everyone who listens. We will see you next week.
Now for an episode relevant audio drop.
I think we ought to try 14-year-olders as adults, down to 14-year-olds as adults, to help our gang task force members fight crime. I know we need to expand the determinant sentencing statutes in the state of Texas.
We have built 75,000 additional state spaces to make sure that we've got room to lock you up if you commit a crime.
I think it's time we abolish parole for Virginia in Virginia and make sure that violent criminals are serving out their full sentences.
We want to go back and cut spending for programs like Midnight Basketball and all of these counseling programs. And we want to take that money and build prisons.